On the evening of September 20th, 2023, in MSU Bozeman's Student Union Ballroom A, the Burton K. Wheeler Center hosted historian Mark C. Johnson as he discussed his latest book, Mansfield and Dirksen, Bipartisan Giants of the Senate. The lecture, titled Montana, Mansfield, and the Lost Art of Bipartisanship, began with an introduction by Burton K. Wheeler Center Board Chair Chuck Tooley.
My name is Chuck Tooley, and I'm Board Chair of the Wheeler Center for Public Policy. So our speaker this evening is Mark Johnson, a distinguished author, journalist, broadcaster, and the author of books on U.S. Senate history, including his latest, Mansfield and Dirksen, Bipartisan Giants of the Senate. Mark is a fellow at the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana and is a member of the board of directors of the Burton K. Wheeler Center, where he serves on our executive committee. If you read the Bozeman Daily Chronicle on September 16th, you may have noticed his excellent guest opinion on bipartisanship in government, co-authored by our Wheeler Center executive director, Laurel Angel. Mark's previous books from the University of Oklahoma Press are Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party, a study of how independent expenditure campaigns upended American politics after 1980, and Political Hellraiser, a biography of Montana New Deal era Senator Burton K. Wheeler, a Spur Award finalist by the Western Writers of America. Johnson served as press secretary and chief of staff to Idaho's longest-serving senator, Cecil D. Andrus. He lives in Manzanita, Oregon, with his wife, Trish. Please help me give a warm Montana welcome to Mark Johnson.
Good evening, everyone. The first sentence of this book, Mansfield and Dirksen, kind of says it all. The first sentence is, this is a story of a United States Senate that no longer exists. I set out to write about Mike Mansfield because I have long admired his record in Congress and the Senate, knew him to be an extraordinary American, an extraordinary Montanan, and I really wanted to write about him, although there's an excellent, excellent biography by the late Don Obendorfer. So I went searching for another angle to approach the Mansfield story. And I, rather by happenstance, discovered this rather remarkable, particularly remarkable in the context of our time, this remarkable relationship between the Democratic leader of the Senate in the 60s and the Republican leader of the Senate in the 60s, Everett Dirksen. So why should we care about Mike Mansfield? Well, one quote that particularly struck me in my research was a comment made by David Broder, who some of you will remember as a syndicated columnist, longtime Washington Post correspondent, who covered every president from Dwight Eisenhower to Barack Obama. David Broder said, Mike Mansfield is the greatest American I ever met. And Dirksen is absolutely unlike anybody in politics today. So this story is set in the decade of the 60s. Mike Mansfield became majority leader early in 1961, following the election of John Kennedy, when the majority leader's job became vacant because Lyndon Johnson had accepted the position as vice president on the Kennedy ticket. So the Senate needed a new majority leader. So the story really begins in 1961 when Mansfield becomes the majority leader, a position he held until 1977 when he left the Senate, still the longest-serving majority leader in the Senate's history. Now, you might think, as I weave the story here, about the accomplishments of these two guys in the decade of the 60s, that, gee, that was a totally different time in our country. But remember what was going on in the 60s. It wasn't just the Beatles and the Summer of Love and safely returning a man from the moon. It was a very, very contentious decade. Civil rights protests, church bombings in the South, killing young African-American girls on a Sunday morning, college students murdered in the mere pursuit of getting African Americans the opportunity to register to vote in southern states. You had the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Bay of Pigs at the very beginning of John Kennedy's administration, a host of other international conflicts that really sort of marked a spike in the Cold War between the then Soviet Union and the United States. And of course, the assassination of one president, his brother a few years later, and the murder of the foremost civil rights leader in the country, Dr. Martin Luther King. And laid over all of that is the increasing American focus on the war in Indochina, the Vietnam War. Yet somehow, amid this turmoil, these two men, the majority and minority leaders of the Senate, found a way to make that difficult institution function in a way that seems truly remarkable with the hindsight of 60 years or so. So how Mike Mansfield and Everett Dirksen came about their Senate work is what this book is about. It's easy to think that the Senate has always been as dysfunctional as it seems to be today, but that would be a mistake, because it was not dysfunctional, even given all of the turmoil that was going on in the United States in the 1960s. Take just a moment to consider the institution of the Senate. It is perhaps the most undemocratic, small d, institution in any democracy in the world, with the possible exception of the British House of Lords. But it's not a democratic institution. Every state, regardless of size, has two senators. In writing The Federalist 62, James Madison conceded that the arrangement, two senators for every state, had no basis in democratic theory, but was merely an expedient to convince the small states to sign on to the new union and embrace the Constitution. So Wyoming, with 585,000 residents, is represented by two senators, as is California and its 39 million residents. There are quirky rules in the Senate, unlimited debate, the filibuster, the supermajority that is required to cut off debate and actually cut off procrastination, if you will, intransigence, and move to a final vote on a piece of legislation. That's all designed to protect the minority, of course. There are many examples of the present dysfunction. The former Alabama football coach, who somehow wound up in the United States Senate, is now put a hold on over 300 military appointments, senior military appointments, because he can. A single United States senator can do that. We're staring right down the barrel of another government shutdown, maybe not so much as a result of the Senate's inability to act, but clearly not being helped by the partisan divide in the Senate. The committee system, which in the Mansfield-Dirksen era functioned in a way that is hard to believe today, hardly ever functions at all. I quote Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley in the book as saying he was surprised after his first 2 years in the Senate to actually stumble upon an actual debate on the Senate floor, where two senators were actually engaged back and forth in debating an issue. The greatest deliberative body in the world hardly deliberates anymore. Yet the Constitution embodies the Senate with a tremendous power. The confirmation of cabinet members, federal judges, Supreme Court justices, the power to ratify treaties. And at least by historical standards, and this is certainly the case in Mansfield's experience, a major voice on foreign policy issues. But that's the Senate we have. You'll often see commentators say, well, we have to change the Senate. We have to get away from this undemocratic representation. Well, good luck with that. It's written into the Constitution. And you know how difficult it is to change the Constitution. So it is not likely to change anytime soon. It is the Senate we have. Therefore, to make that Senate work, Mansfield and Dirksen knew that they had to work together in the national interest and not exclusively in the interest of their own parties or merely to thwart the program of a president of the other party. Mansfield often said that he had three great loves, his wife Maureen, Montana, and the Senate. And it sounds kind of quaint to say it today, but both of these guys were Senate institutionalists who subscribed to Mansfield's view, as he often said, that the Senate is the rock of the Republic. Utterly opposite personalities. Dirksen was flamboyant, He'd have been an aspiring actor as a young man. He actually wrote 100 plays, none of which were published. So he loved the limelight. He aspired to be an actor. His mother finally convinced him that he could not make a living as an actor. So what does he do? He goes into politics, show business by other means. He cultivated a particular kind of persona. He had a mop of unruly white hair that always looked like it needed a comb through it, a suit that was often a size or two too large for him, a speaking style more familiar to the 1880s than the 1960s. A reporter once asked Dirksen a question that probably all politicians would avoid at all costs. What was his favorite beverage? He said, well, we have a strict division in my family. My wife likes champagne. I'm a friend of Jonathan Daniels. He had a deep and distinctive baritone, a voice that probably next to John Kennedy's Boston Brogue or Lyndon Johnson's Hill Country Twang was the most recognizable political voice in the country. He was a superb orator at a time when the ability to make a speech in public was very valuable as a political asset. But he never was inclined to use 10 words when 100 would work better. One reporter dubbed him the Wizard of Ooze. Others called him Honey Tonsils and the Rumpled Magician of the Metaphor. The photo here shows Dirksen in one of his favorite poses, talking to reporters. He would climb atop a desk, sitting cross-legged, Buddha-like, smoking a cigarette, answering reporters' questions. Mansfield, totally different personality. Quiet, shy, ramrod straight, perhaps a function of his military training, particularly the Marine Corps. As far as I can tell, and other historians have looked into it as well, Mike Mansfield is the only member of Congress to ever serve in three different branches of the military. He falsified his birth certificate at age 16 in order to be able to enlist in the United States Navy. This was during World War I. He served in the Navy, he later served in the Army, and finally in the Marine Corps, including a short stint in China. He was extremely proud of his Marine Corps service, and you'll notice the lapel pin he's wearing in this photograph was the Marine Corps emblem, which he hardly ever was without. Yet he was remarkably devoid of ego and the need for publicity. One time on an ABC Sunday morning program, Issues and Answers, in the space of a 30-minute interview, Mansfield answered 62 different questions, many with a simple yup or a nope, and occasionally, I haven't the faintest idea. Consequently, reporters loved him, and unlike virtually every other politician then and now, he was generally publicity shy. Time magazine's Capitol correspondent, congressional correspondent, Neil McNeil, knew these guys really well. He wrote a biography of Dirksen and interviewed Mansfield on many occasions. McNeil calling Mansfield off the Senate floor one day into the president's room just off the Senate floor, and he said, Senator, I have some bad news for you. The editors of Time magazine have decided they want to carve your face on Mount Rushmore. Mansfield said, what do you mean? He said, they want to put you on the cover of Time magazine. And Mansfield said, oh, my gosh, we can't let that happen. How can we stop that? He genuinely did not want the publicity. Yet he did wind up on the cover of Time magazine. The banner across the cover of Time, this was from 1964, right at the start that the Senate was taking up the Civil Rights Act, it says, can Democrats control a Democratic Senate? This was an article that sort of questioned whether Mansfield was up to the job of being the Senate Majority Leader. He clearly was up to the job. And the contrast with the way he approached the leadership of the Senate and the approach that his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, had could not be more stark. He was a domineering, demanding, aggressive, arm-twisting, backslapping, difficult to get along with SOB a lot of the time. Mansfield, entirely different approach to Senate leadership. Nothing illustrates this difference better than that civil rights bill in 1964. So Mansfield understood Dirksen's need to be at the center of every picture. And here he is, literally at the center of a picture, meeting with the major leaders of the civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King, that's Walter Reuther, James Farmer, and a very young John Lewis, a future congressman from Georgia. Mansfield met with all these people, too. You just won't find a photograph of him meeting with them. So Dirksen, in order to be effective with his own Republican caucus, needed to be seen in fact as well as in image as a true leader of the Senate. Mansfield completely understood that. So literally, he empowered Dirksen to lead on the Civil Rights Bill in 1964. Mansfield, however, devised the overall strategy. So remember the context of the times. President Kennedy has been assassinated in November of 1963, shortly after bringing finally to Congress a civil rights bill that he had delayed offering up since the beginning of his presidency. His murder prompts Lyndon Johnson to realize this is a moment when we can really push forward on civil rights. And Johnson realized that he had to bring about a great legislative accomplishment in this area in order to position himself for his own presidential election in November of 1964. So Johnson wants to pull out all the stops to get congressional approval of the Civil Rights Act, an act that, for the first time since the Civil War, attempted to eliminate the last vestiges of segregation in our society, to give African Americans equal opportunity in all kinds of different ways in our society. But it was controversial, needless to say, particularly with a major element of Mansfield's own Democratic Party, the Southern Segregationists. Half a dozen or 15 members of the Senate from the states of the old Confederacy who were determined, as they had so many times before, to block passage of a civil rights bill. So Mansfield, from the very beginning, knows the only way we're going to get this done, knowing that these Democrats, led by Georgia's powerful Senator Richard Russell, would filibuster the bill as long as they possibly could to try to prevent passage. So he knows, the majority leader knows, he must have Republican votes to get this done. So Mansfield devised the strategy, and he gave to Dirksen the political running room to work legislative magic with fellow Republicans. I want to read just one section of Mansfield's speech when he opened debate on the Civil Rights Bill in 1964. He says, "Mr. President," and I quote, "great public issues are not subject to personal timetables. They do not accommodate themselves to our individual preferences or convenience. They emerge in their own way and in their own time. We do not compel them. They compel us." Earlier, he had said, the senator from Montana has no lust for this conflict. Yet this question is one that invites conflict. It engages and divides deeply. He says, "we look in vain if we look backward to vast accomplishments that might spare the Senate the necessity of a difficult decision on the civil rights question. We hope in vain if we hope this issue can be put over safely to another tomorrow, to be dealt with by another generation of senators. The time is now. The crossroads is the Senate." So he knows the bill is going to be filibustered by Russell and his allies in the South. What does he do? Well, in a remarkable act by a partisan politician, he goes to his chief opponent, Russell, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. He's been in the Senate since Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, powerful individual, extremely well respected despite his segregationist background. He goes to Dick Russell and he lays out the entire game plan for him, how he's going to approach the civil rights bill. He says to Russell, "I'm going to stop the bill when it comes over from the House at the desk, and I'm going to hold it so that we can have a real debate on civil rights in the Senate." He says, "I am not going to have it referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by another powerful Southerner, Jim Eastland of Mississippi, because I know he'll kill it, he'll bottle it up, and we won't get a chance to debate it, as he's done so many times before. But I won't pull any other tricks. I won't do anything to catch you unaware. I will forecast every move that I'm going to make." We know this conversation took place because Dick Russell conveyed it to his biographer that Mansfield had done this. I've seen the memo that Mansfield wrote to the file that's in his archive at the University of Montana. So he commemorated this incredible meeting. I've used the analogy, it would be like the Montana State Bobcat quarterback handing the day's playbook to the middle linebacker across the aisle and say, here's how the game is going to proceed. That's exactly what Mansfield did. Really unprecedented in the annals of politics, at least as far as I know. So Mansfield devised the strategy. He put Hubert Humphrey in charge on the Democratic side of leading the debate. They had a team of Democratic senators who mastered the details of this very complex piece of legislation so that they could debate literally every line of the legislation, which they did over the course of many, many days in the summer of 1964. Remarkably, and this is why historians love Professor, who becomes Majority Leader, we have all of these contemporary notes in Mansfield's own words about what happened during this period. So consistent with Mansfield's belief that Dirksen had to not only be seen as influencing the Civil Rights Bill, but had to genuinely lead the effort, all of the strategy meetings on the legislation were held in Dirksen's office, never in the majority leader's office. Dirksen was the one who spoke to the press. Dirksen met with a delegation of the clergy and civil rights leaders. Dirksen got the attention. Dirksen could accurately claim to skeptical Republicans that he was looking out for their and the Republican Party's best interests. Ironically, as one historian has written, and I agree, Mansfield actually accumulated power in the Senate by giving it away to Dirksen. His approach, the civility, the modesty, the fairness, the complete candor, earned him even more respect across the partisan divide. His influence grew by sharing power. And ultimately, Dirksen did corral those votes on his side of the aisle. And in his famous speech urging fellow Republicans to support the Civil Rights Act, he almost quoted Victor Hugo, "Stronger than all the armies is an idea whose time has come." One historian said, Dirksen actually improved on Victor Hugo. In the end, the Senate endured an 83-day filibuster, still the longest in Senate history, 534 hours, 1 minute, and 51 seconds. And the vote was 73-27 in favor of that historic legislation. 27 of the 33 Republicans in the Senate voted in favor, following Dirksen's lead, and spanning the ideological spectrum of the then Republican Party, from Northeastern liberals like Jacob Javits from New York to Midwestern conservatives like Roman Ruska from Nebraska. Interestingly, not including Barry Goldwater, everyone knew was likely to be the Republican presidential nominee against Lyndon Johnson. All the Democratic votes came from the states of the old Confederacy, prompting Johnson to say to one of his aides that the Democrats had lost the South for a generation, a prediction that seems now decidedly too optimistic. So Dirksen deserves great credit for the legislation, and he's gotten it from historians. Mansfield less so, even though I argue in the book he deserves every bit as much credit for devising the strategy to actually position the Senate so that it could vote in favor of this landmark legislation. Mansfield said simply after the Senate debate had concluded, "Yep, I was after the votes, not the publicity. And we got them." Two pictures of Dirksen. He's in the middle of the frame, as always, and he's admiring a portrait of himself. You'll see in the background there a small bust of Abraham Lincoln. Dirksen hailed from central Illinois, the area that Abraham Lincoln had represented in Congress in the 1840s. He loved to be referred to as the senator from the land of Lincoln. When Lyndon Johnson wanted to really stroke him, he always referred to him as the senator from the land of Lincoln. And, of course, Mansfield's at the very edge of the photo, sort of peeking over Dirksen's shoulder. This is a meeting that took place at the White House in 1962 when Kennedy's president. So you see all the Democratic leadership here. Lyndon Johnson right in the middle of the frame, the vice president at the time, speaking to Speaker McCormick from the House. That's a future speaker, Carl Albert from Oklahoma. In the far corners, right behind him, is Hale Boggs, who was the House Majority Whip. On the other side of the frame, the tall guy next to Johnson is George Smathers from Florida, who is the Democratic Conference Chairman. Next to him is Hubert Humphrey, future vice president, future presidential candidate. And Mansfield's got his back to the camera. He's leaving. John Kennedy loved this picture so much that he had a copy made and inscribed it to Mansfield. He said to Mike, who knows when to go and when to stay. September 25th, 1963, less than 2 months before Kennedy's murder in Dallas, he was in Billings. Kennedy had organized, White House staff had organized a major trip across the West for the president to have the opportunity to talk about conservation issues. We didn't use the word environmentalism in those days. It was conservation. And he made that speech in several different locations. By the time he got to Billings at the fairgrounds, apparently he was tiring of the message, and he really wanted to talk about what had happened the day before in the Senate when Mansfield's leadership again, with Dirksen, had come up with the votes to pass the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the foundational treaty that determines every other nuclear arms limitation effort since that time. Kennedy considered it the singularly important foreign policy accomplishment of his presidency. And when he gets to Billings, Mansfield actually introduces the president, and Kennedy spends the first few minutes of his speech saying how fortunate Montana was that this guy was in a position in the Senate and how fortunate he was as president to have his support in the Senate. And then he singled out Dirksen for his bipartisan support of that nuclear arms limitation treaty back in 1963. Both of these guys had remarkable relationships with the presidents that, as Mansfield said, I didn't serve under any president, I served with presidents. But remarkable relationship with the presidents they served with. I would venture to say that there has been no Senate leader with a closer relationship with the president than Mike Mansfield had with John Kennedy. They came to the Senate in the same election in 1952. When they took their seats early in 1953, they were assigned seats next to each other in the back row on the Democratic side in the Senate chamber. Two Irish Catholics. Admittedly, Kennedy came from a little better economic upbringing than Mike Mansfield did. But they became very close, almost a, maybe not a father-son relationship, but an uncle-nephew kind of relationship. They were very, very close. So close, in fact, that when the president was murdered in Dallas, Jackie Kennedy wanted only Mike Mansfield to deliver the eulogy at the memorial service for President Kennedy in the Capitol building. She was told that protocol demanded that someone from the House also speak. So Speaker McCormick made remarks, as did the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Earl Warren. But it's only Mansfield's speech that is remembered today. Even though it was a little bit controversial at the time, I think because some people did not realize what Mansfield was doing, not with a speech so much as almost a prose poem. And I want to read just a couple of lines from it because it is quite an extraordinary speech. Over that horrible weekend between Kennedy's murder on Friday and the memorial service a couple of days later, Mansfield had read a newspaper article to the effect that Mrs. Kennedy had removed her wedding ring and placed it in the hand of her dead husband before his casket was closed. And he used that symbolism of her removing her wedding ring and placing it in his hand to knit together this eulogy. So here's a couple of lines. There was a sound of laughter, and in a moment, it was no more. And so she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hand. There was a wit in a man neither young nor old, but a wit full of an old man's wisdom and a child's wisdom. And then in a moment, it was no more. And so she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hand. So some criticized the eulogy for being tone deaf. It really spoke nothing about Kennedy's accomplishments in office, but spoke to the intensity of the moment. A nation shocked this young widow with two young children. And subsequently, I think it had been recognized as one of the great eulogies ever delivered in a political setting. Lady Bird Johnson would record in her diary, "I shall never forget Mike Mansfield's speech. He, the most precise and restrained of men, repeated over and over the phrase, and she took a ring from her finger and placed it in his hand. William Manchester wrote a famous book called The Death of the President about the events in Dallas that day in November of 1963, and he realized that Jackie Kennedy absolutely loved the way Mansfield had handled the eulogy. And he wrote, "Only Jacqueline Kennedy could judge Mike Mansfield, and she couldn't believe what she was hearing. She didn't know a eulogy could be this magnificent. Looking up into his suffering eyes and his gaunt mountain man face, she thought his profile was like a 16th century El Greco. To her, the speech itself was as eloquent as a Greek oration, or Lincoln's letter to the mother who had lost five sons in battle. It didn't turn aside from the ghastly reality. It was, Jackie Kennedy thought, the one thing that said what had happened." So in Mansfield's archives in Missoula are handwritten notes from Jackie Kennedy to Senator Mansfield, thanking him for the eulogy, thanking Mike and Maureen Mansfield for visiting her a few days after the president's death. And then 10 years later, one of the networks to commemorate, to memorialize the Kennedy assassination, ran a special in prime time on the 10th anniversary of that awful event. Mrs. Kennedy watched the program, and she wrote a really touching note back to Mansfield saying how much he had meant to her and to the president. Everett Dirksen had a somewhat different relationship with Lyndon Johnson, probably almost as close. One reporter referred to it as a relationship between crooks, meaning, I think, in the best good-natured sense of that term, that these guys were transactional politicians. They were very much into deal-making. The story is told that at the end of the legislative day, Dirksen would often go to the White House to have a couple of bourbons with President Johnson. And during the course of the conversation, Johnson would say, "Well, you know, Ev, I need two or three votes. I need two or three Republican votes on a piece of legislation that's coming up." Dirksen would get into his gravelly voiced brow and say, "Well, Mr. President, I'll see what I can do." And then he would reach inside of his coat pocket, pull out a piece of paper and say, "Well, Mr. President, as long as you mention it, I have an appointment here to the Federal Communications Commission that I want you to." So they were very transactional. Lady Bird Johnson remembered walking in on them when they were discussing strategy about the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And these two old Pauls sitting in the Oval Office, literally nose to nose, you know, smiling, joshing with each other, probably cursing each other a little bit, but finding a way to move forward. And Lady Bird said she came back 2 hours later and they were exactly in the same pose. So with a possible exception of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal in 1933, and again in sometimes referred to as the Second New Deal in 1935, B.K. Wheeler contributing to that Second New Deal, the Public Utilities Holding Company Act of 1935. With the possible exception of that period, no president has had more impact on a legislative agenda than Lyndon Johnson did during his presidency in the 60s. So this is just a partial list of what passed the Senate in that period. The Civil Rights Legislation, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Wilderness Act passed in 1964. In no small part because of the work of Senator Metcalf from this state. There was a Gun Control Act passed after Robert Kennedy's assassination in 1968. Mansfield supported that gun control bill, caught some grief for it in Montana. It was an election year for him, it was approaching an election year for him. He knew he would receive a fair amount of criticism for it, which he did. Metcalf would say later that Mike Mansfield is the only Westerner in the Senate who could vote for a gun control bill and get away with it. So the Food Stamp Act, Fair Housing Act, passed near the end of Dirksen's life, 1968. Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which created PBS and National Public Radio. Medicare. All of that legislation passed, and it's just a partial list. It was remarkable to me as I did some of the research on the legislative history of some of this legislation that much of it passed the Senate, not because it wasn't controversial. Almost every piece was controversial. Many of the pieces of legislation passed on a voice vote in the Senate, which underscores one thing that Mansfield often talked about, which is political self-restraint. There's a certain level of power that every United States senator has, the senator from Alabama exercising his power right now over these military appointments. Mansfield said, you know, you don't always have to use all the power you have. So I think one of the explanations for why so much of this legislation was able to be passed without filibustering, and some of it, quite significant legislation, passing on voice votes, was because Mansfield had modeled a certain kind of behavior in the Senate that said you don't have to filibuster it just because you can, knowing that the legislation is ultimately going to pass. So it's a remarkable level of political leadership by not exercising all the power that is available. It's been said, and I think correctly so, that we live in Lyndon Johnson's world. And if you look at that list of accomplishments, so much of that legislation remains so vital, so important to American society today. If it is true that we live in LBJ's world, then we also have to say we live in the world of Mike Mansfield and Everett Dirksen, because they very clearly engineered the legislative accomplishments that allowed these pieces of legislation to pass. I want to leave you just with a couple more thoughts from Senator Mansfield. I don't want to leave you with the impression that his approach to political leadership did not have its detractors, because it clearly did. Mostly members of his own party in the Senate who thought he wasn't tough enough, wasn't willing to use the power effectively that a majority leader has, was too deferential to Dirksen. And he was criticized for it, increasingly criticized in 1962 when it seemed like Kennedy's legislative package was really stalled on Capitol Hill. And into 1963, when things seemed to be stalled out in Kennedy's legislative agenda. So Mansfield let the criticism run off his back for some period of time, but he finally, in November of 1963, decided, I need to address this criticism. I need to explain my approach to political leadership. And he prepared a speech that he was intending to deliver in the Senate on Friday afternoon, November 22nd, 1963, the day when John Kennedy was murdered in Dallas. So obviously the Senate adjourned upon the news of the president's death, and Mansfield did not deliver that speech. He entered it into the congressional record. I'm fairly confident that every member of the Senate read that speech. And it wasn't until many years later when Trent Lott, the Republican majority leader at the time from Mississippi, along with his Democratic counterpart, Tom Daschle of South Dakota, invited Mansfield back to the Senate to deliver this speech on Senate leadership. So here's part of what he said in that speech. I do my best to be courteous, he said, decent and understanding of others, and sometimes I fail. But it is for the Senate to decide whether these characteristics are incompatible with leadership. I have tried to treat others as I would like to be treated and almost invariably have been. And it is for the Senate to decide, too, whether that characteristic is incompatible with Senate leadership. And finally, within this body, I believe every member ought to be equal in fact, not less than in theory, and that they have a primary responsibility to the people whom they represent to face the legislative issues of the nation. And to the extent the Senate may be inadequate in this connection, the remedy lies not in the seeking of shortcuts, not in the cracking of non-existent whips, not in wheeling and dealing, but in an honest facing of the situation and a resolution by the Senate itself, by accommodation, by respect for one another, by mutual restraint, and, as necessary, adjustments to the procedures of this body. Very late in his life, 1998, Mansfield gave an interview to the New York Times in which he said, and I'll quote it, I've always felt that the true strength of the Senate lay in the center, not on the right and not on the left, but with those people who could see both sides and were not so convinced of their own assumptions that they wouldn't listen to the other side. One of Mansfield's aides, Francis Vallejo, compared his leadership of the Senate to Mahatma Gandhi's leadership of the independence movement in India during the 1930s, a nonviolent approach to politics. Another aide, Charles Ferris, was asked one time, well, what were Mansfield's real politics? Was he a liberal? Was he more conservative? And Chuck Ferris said, "I think of Mansfield like I think of Charles de Gaulle, the great wartime leader of the French and later French president." He said, "De Gaulle was neither a man of the right or the left. He was above." And that's Mike Mansfield. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to entertain a few questions. Well, there's one argument, line of argument, that holds that the Senate has really only been relevant, really relevant, three times in our history. Once was in the run-up to and during the Civil War in the 1850s and 1860s, and maybe shortly after the Civil War when the post-Civil War constitutional amendments were adopted. Again, in the 1930s, during the Roosevelt administration, when the Senate really led much of Roosevelt's legislative package, things like Social Security and passage of Banking Act and some of those major issues that happened during the beginning of Roosevelt's administration, very, very important in the Senate. And then the third period would be this period, in the 1960s, when the Senate really seemed to be maybe be all that the founders had envisioned that it might be, a place where the nation's issues were litigated and ultimately legislated, not where every piece of legislation goes to die or goes to be picked apart on a partisan basis. Mansfield himself said this was a remarkable period. And he had lots of accomplishments in the 1970s, some of which were less legislative than administrative in terms of the Senate's power in the case of the investigation of the intelligence agencies, the Church Committee investigation in 1975, which Mansfield had his fingerprints all over. The Watergate investigation, where he handpicked the members of the Watergate Committee to investigate the Nixon administration and the crimes of Watergate. But those were less legislative accomplishments than what happened in the 1960s. So Mansfield himself said this is a remarkable period, and you get a relationship like I had with Dirksen maybe once in 100 years. So it may really have been just a one-off almost in our history that these two personalities came together at this particular time, at a time when the country seemed willing to grapple with some really big issues like civil rights and medical care for elderly Americans. So it may have just been a one-off that just happened to be the right people in the right time. I will say one thing about Mansfield and Dirksen that kind of defies understanding given the intense partisanship that exists today. I mean, these guys really liked each other. Once on Mansfield's birthday, there was kind of a spontaneous celebration on the Senate floor of his birthday. And senator after senator rose to their feet to applaud his leadership, how fair he was, what an admirable man of integrity he was. And during the speeches, Dirksen leaps to his feet and says, "Mike, we love you." I mean, you can imagine Mitch McConnell doing that, right? And Mansfield reciprocated. Dirksen loved flowers. He was a gardener. He tried to make the marigold the national flower on several different occasions. But he tended his flowers carefully and religiously. So Mansfield would frequently send him big bouquets of flowers to his office, just for no apparent reason, just because, you know, he liked the guy. And Dirksen would reciprocate. In 1967, maybe 68, push was on to create the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. And Dirksen actually wrote fundraising letters to some of his chief political contributors asking them to contribute to this center for this Democrat. And one of the guys that he wrote to turned out to be one of the original founders of the John Birch Society. So this guy writes back to Dirksen saying, "I can't believe you're raising money for this liberal Democrat." And Dirksen writes back to him and says, "Well, it's true that Mike Mansfield and I don't agree on many things, but he's a great American. He's a really, really decent guy. And by the way, what's happened to you?" Sort of transcended the give and take of partisanship and, you know, my good friend, the senator from left overshoe. It was much deeper than that and much more genuine, I think, their friendship and their regard for each other, the mutual respect that they held for each other. One of the real pleasures of researching this book was the Miller Center at the University of Virginia has archived all of the presidential telephone calls that were recorded. Lyndon Johnson recorded hours of presidential phone calls, including many with Mansfield and many with Dirksen. And there's one occasion where, during the civil rights debate in 1964, when it wasn't entirely clear yet that Dirksen was really going to embrace this piece of legislation, Dirksen serves notice through the press that he's going down to the White House to basically put down his conditions to President Johnson for supporting this bill. Johnson gets all huffy about it and says to Mansfield on one of these recorded phone calls, he says, "What's with Dirksen? He's acting terrible. He's a much bigger man than that. What's he up to?" And then he goes off on a tangent and says, you might remember the famous photo of the president, Johnson, holding up his beagle dogs by their ear. He says to Mansfield, "He's even criticizing me for my treatment of my damn dogs," he says. "And I know more about dogs than he'll ever know." And he goes off on this tangent, Mansfield just kind of chuckling in the background. And finally he says, "Well, how should I handle Dirksen when he comes down here?" Mansfield says, "Just assure him that we have this legislation under control. It's our responsibility to get it passed. We're on the job. Scratch his back and send him back up to the hill," he says. So just another example of Mansfield sort of understanding the personality that he's dealing with. Yeah, it may have just been a brilliant moment, a quirky moment when, you know, things were possible because there was really extraordinary leadership in Congress. The one great failing, arguably, that these two guys had was Vietnam. Dirksen became Lyndon Johnson's foremost defender in the Senate for his Vietnam policy. And most of you who know your Mansfield history know that he was one of the earliest opponents of American involvement, putting ground troops into South Vietnam. They never could reconcile those two positions. And frankly, there's not much evidence that they really tried to reconcile. Perhaps Mansfield just understood that Dirksen, a Republican cold warrior, grew up in the age of Joe McCarthy, believed in the domino theory in Southeast Asia, that there was just no convincing him that U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia was ultimately going to be a disaster for the country and for South Vietnam. That's, in a way, a great failing of these two guys in that period when they seemed to be able to get on the same page in so many other ways. I think you're 98% correct. All of the factors that you outline that exist today that didn't exist in the Mansfield-Dirksen era is spot on. You had a totally different media environment. You had the ideological spread in the Republican and Democratic parties. So I think all of that is accurate. Here's where I would maybe modify your thesis just slightly. And that is, particularly in Mansfield's case, realizing that the country needed two strong political parties. That after 1964, James Rustin, the famous New York Times reporter, covered Congress, columnist, wrote basically Republican Party's dead after Goldwater's landslide loss in 1964. So I think the leadership comes in a couple of different ways. One is the default position of partisans is to oppose the other side. That's the default position. So Dirksen had to figure out a way to overcome that knee-jerk reaction to opposing John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson on important things, like the nuclear test ban treaty, for example. Mansfield's leadership asserted itself in a somewhat different way, I think. After that landslide election in 1964, and when it became obvious that the Congress needed to act on a voting rights bill in 1965, and remember your history to the extent that the voting rights march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, early in 1965, that was broken up by Alabama Highway Patrol troopers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on the outskirts of Selma, where John Lewis was beaten to the point of needing hospitalization. That was a pivotal moment when it became obvious that Congress had to act on a second big civil rights bill right in the wake of a presidential election and the passage earlier of the Civil Rights Act in 64. Johnson had told Martin Luther King that, yeah, I want to pass a Voting Rights Act, but I don't think I can do it in 1965. Selma changed the equation for Johnson. So here's what Mansfield does. He uses the Democratic Conference early in 1965. Johnson used the conference to basically lay down the party line and say, here's how we're going to approach this particular issue as Democrats. Mansfield used the party conference to say, the Republicans suffered a huge defeat last November. We need to find a way way to raise up the Republican Party. We need to make sure that they are a full partner in the passage of the next piece of civil rights legislation. Mansfield considered the Voting Rights Act perhaps the greatest legislative accomplishment of his tenure as majority leader. So he realized that we have to find a way to make these guys sort of get back in the game after Barry Goldwater's debacle. So that's the kind of leadership, I think, that did assert itself in that period. The ideological difference in the political parties from then to now is stark. It is a major reason why it is so difficult to find middle ground, because there are so few people who identify anywhere close to the middle. It's been said many times, the most conservative Democrat is more liberal than the most liberal Republican, and vice versa in the Senate. So that's the way the parties have sorted themselves into these ideological baskets. And that is a lot different than it was in the Mansfield-Dirksen era. Both had pretty hardscrabble upbringings. Mansfield shipped to Great Falls when his mother died when he was quite young. His father was hurt in an industrial construction accident quite seriously, so was not able to take care of children. So Mike winds up with relatives in Great Falls. He drops out of school, by his own admission, was a troubled kid, goes off, enlists in the military against his father's wishes, and comes back from that military experience with literally no prospects, no high school degree. So what does he do? Well, apparently what many young men in Montana did at that time, get a job in the mines in Butte, doing the worst possible job, mucking the ore, as they say, loading copper ore into the underground trains to take it out of the mine. Luckily, he meets Maureen Hayes at that point. She's a teacher, and she convinces him that unless he wants to spend the rest of his life in the copper mines, he's got to complete his education. So he effectively earns his high school diploma while he's seeking his bachelor's degree at the University of Montana, then goes on to get a master's degree in history. Dirksen, not unlike that, grew up on a very poor farm on the outskirts of Pekin, Illinois. I talked about his wanting to be an actor, which probably not something that you really aspire to as a secure financial future. Eventually serves in the military as well in World War I. Saw combat in Europe, comes back, goes to law school at the University of Minnesota, and enters politics, first at on the local level, and then gets elected to Congress in the Roosevelt landslide in 1932. So he's one of the very few Republicans who won a congressional seat as a newcomer in 1932. And this is the period of the Depression. So yeah, I think it was a very, very difficult time for both of them. But I do think that in some people, at least, such adversity breeds character and integrity. And I think both of these guys had that in spades. Yeah, I think he was a consummate political wheeler dealer. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. He knew how to make a political deal. He knew how to be convincing with his colleagues. The civil rights legislation, the voting rights legislation, should not have been seen as a liberal versus conservative issue, but in many ways it was. You've got these conservative Democrats from the South opposing it. You've got many conservatives in the Republican Party opposing it. Yet Dirksen was able to bring along a guy like Len Jordan from Idaho, who had been governor in the 50s and then went to the Senate in the 1960s, extremely conservative Republican. He votes for both of these acts, votes for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, not because he was getting a lot of pressure to do so back home, but because he accepted the arguments that Dirksen advanced, that this was good for the country, good for the Republican Party, and ultimately good for individual senators to be on the right side of history in those cases. He was a reluctant supporter of a good deal of the Johnson agenda, but he wound up supporting very much of it, including Medicare, the Fair Housing Act. There's a pretty interesting story in the book about how he came to support the Fair Housing Act and how Lyndon Johnson had convinced him that that was going to be okay for him to support. The parties were ideologically much, much different than they are today, but Dirksen was able to bring along some of those guys like Senator Jordan from Idaho, who at the time would have been considered one of the most conservative members of the Senate. So he was a master back scratcher and deal maker and a rather remarkable political personality at the same time. Nobody, I don't think you could say, like him in American politics today. The conservative bloc in the Senate in the Dirksen 60s, they may have been upset with him because they saw him as being too pally around with Lyndon Johnson, for example. But unlike Kevin McCarthy in the House today, he didn't have a faction of the Senate Republican Party that was out for his scalp every Monday morning. So he had a great deal more flexibility to maneuver as a political leader than, frankly, most members of Congress do today who are in positions of leadership. Robert Carroll, Lyndon Johnson's biographer, dubs Johnson the master of the Senate. I think if you say Johnson was a master of the Senate, you have to say Mansfield was too. And I'll give you just one quick example of that. 1965, again, voting rights, the issue. One of Mansfield's aides comes to him and says, "Boss, the natives are getting restless," meaning the Democratic caucus is getting restless. "Dirksen is getting all of the attention on this piece of legislation. All the meetings are held in his office. He's the one that's on TV every night. He's the one that's being quoted in the press and appearing on the Sunday morning talk shows. And couldn't we just once in a while have a meeting in the majority leader's office?" And Mansfield says, "No." He said, "It's really, really important for the country to see the Republican leader of the Senate, the most prominent Republican in the country, talking about voting rights every night on TV. So we're going to do it just exactly the way we've been doing it." So all the meetings were held in Dirksen's office. When the legislation passes, Dirksen takes the bows. He gets the congratulatory telegrams from the civil rights leadership. But again, I think Mansfield understood how to use that relationship and motivate Dirksen to do what he wanted him to do ultimately, which was to make sure there were enough Republican votes to get the piece of legislation passed. Well, it's been great fun to be with you tonight in Bozeman, and thanks so much for coming.
You have just heard a lecture titled "Montana, Mansfield, and the Lost Art of Bipartisanship," hosted by MSU Bozeman's Burton K. Wheeler Center on September 20th, 2023, featuring historian Mark C. Johnson discussing his latest book, "Mansfield and Dirksen, Bipartisan Giants of the Senate," published by University of Oklahoma Press. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.